Our second case this morning is United States against Gaddis. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Lyndon Barber. With Colonel Mark Pelatocci, I represent the appellant, Sergeant Troy Gaddis. Appellant's defense, his only defense in this case, was that his stepdaughter, referred to as T.E., fabricated the charges against him. At the heart of this defense is this question: why would appellant's stepdaughter fabricate such a story against him? The alleged victim's motive to fabricate these charges is articulated by defense counsel at Joint Appendix 2, page 9, and it is simply this. She had a motive to fabricate to hide acts of consensual activity from her mother, acts of consensual activity with someone other than the appellant. By blaming on the appellant any results of a looming physical exam which her mother
had... What evidence of that? You say consensual activity. Are you trying to avoid using the sex word here, or is that purposeful?
Your Honor, the alleged victim's own words, according to the statement that was attached by the statement of Mercedes Gilchrist, attached to the defense motion, said that the looming physical exam that her mother had threatened might show, she was concerned about it because it might show that Bubby had messed with her previously.
And was there evidence of that? What is your response to the government's argument that we're dealing with no more than rumor here?
Your Honor, there was evidence. In fact, the alleged victim testified at the Article 32, as the defense motion sets out, and as trial counsel agreed in the MRE 412 hearing, that the facts were correct. At the Article 32 hearing, the alleged victim testified that she had previously been messed with by someone other than the appellant. That is consistent, then, with the statement that her friend made, that upon being told that she was being taken for a physical exam, that her first response was, "I don't want to go for a physical exam. It might show something because someone other than appellant messed with me."
Counsel, what didn't the military judge do that the defense asked him to do at trial?
Your Honor, the military judge precluded, and the ruling is clear on the record, precluded any reference to the prior sexual activity of the alleged victim.
Yeah, but didn't the defense counsel at that point essentially agree with that? They said, "This is the question we want to ask." And the military judge said, "Okay, you can ask that," and then actually expanded on that to a certain degree.
Your Honor, that is a portion of the record. However, throughout the questioning of both the alleged victim, her mother, and Mrs. Gilchrist, Mercedes' mother, there were Article 39A sessions where the defense counsel specifically wanted to inquire as to whether the mother of the alleged victim would have been upset if the alleged victim had been sexually active. And the judge, in response to an objection, specifically referencing the judge's 412 ruling, the military judge precluded that line of questioning. When it came time to ask about the alleged prior sexual activities of the alleged victim, the military judge so limited the question, again referring to her 412 ruling, during the course of the trial, that the defense counsel was unable to actually present the truth to the panel. The military judge's ruling was that her limitation, saying you can't refer to the prior sexual activity of the alleged victim, her only basis was that it would confuse the panel. In fact, it promoted confusion of the panel, because what the panel heard was that the physical exam was because she was going to a new school and was going to try out for a cheerleader, when in fact the reality and the undisputed facts from the 412 hearing were that she was going to be taken for a physical exam because her mother had discovered an email that alleged prior sexual activity, Your Honor.
Now,
against the context of everything that they were allowed to ask her, drug use, all the rest of the stuff, plus the limited but nonetheless present questioning about sexual activity. How is what was left out constitutionally required?
Your Honor, it was...
That's the problem on which you're relying, is it not?
It is. This is an exception because the evidence was necessary for his Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, his Fifth Amendment right to due process. Why this excluded evidence...
Well, that's what I'm coming to. You tease this one thing out against the background of everything. It seems to me that they were allowed pretty broad questioning of the prosecutress. And how then, in this context, is what was kept out constitutionally required?
Your Honor, it was constitutionally required because it was the only line of cross-examination that went to her motive to fabricate. There was cross-examination about the details of the alleged incident. There were cross-examinations about the relationship between the appellant and the accuser's stepmother. Many things were brought out in cross-examination, but none of them went to the alleged victim's motive to fabricate. And that is why it was constitutionally required. And to specifically...
Talking about cross-examining her about instances of, as I understand, lying in the past and so forth, doesn't go to a motive to fabricate?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because this is a case that is very similar to Williams, where the motive to fabricate was to hide prior sexual activity. In Williams, it was to hide prior sexual activity from a spouse. In this case, it's to hide prior sexual activity, consensual sexual activity from the mother who had been very forthcoming with her daughter about sex is bad, I don't want you to be sexually active.
Counsel, I want to follow up on my earlier question. In the Joint Appendix, the second part of the Joint Appendix, pages 15 and 16, there is a ruling made by the military judge. And there the military judge in the 39A session is recounting the arguments that were made in regard to the 412 motion and says the defense also concedes they will not use the substantive evidence of the email, therefore references to whether or not there was a pregnancy or past sexual activity with a specific person. And so then the military judge goes on to define, restates the question and puts the limitations on it. Did the military judge get that wrong? Or is it your argument now that the defense did not concede that?
Well, Your Honor, it is my argument that the defense did not concede that, but even if the military judge got that right, the judge's limitation was unconstitutional because the questions about using the email for substantive evidence were in the context of the judge twice asking about, will you use extrinsic evidence to prove the acts of sex? In fact, defense counsel was doing, by saying, no, I'm not going to prove that, was avoiding the very thing that the Supreme Court of the United States and this court has cautioned against, which is having many trials about whether or not sex actually occurred between the alleged victim and someone else. So that framing of the issue by the military judge and claiming that the defense counsel had conceded things was not an appropriate conclusion.
But don't you think that if the defense counsel hadn't conceded that, the defense counsel would say, wait a minute, Your Honor, we don't concede that at all. We're contesting that.
No, Your Honor, I believe when you read it in the context, it was, in fact, defense counsel did not plan to introduce the email that the mother had discovered. Repeatedly throughout the 412 hearing, the defense counsel told the judge, we're going to use this in the light of impeachment. This will be something we cross-examine the alleged victim on. So the defense counsel was simply precluding the use of extrinsic evidence and saying we don't plan to introduce this email. But the judge's ruling didn't go just to the admissibility of the email, Your Honor. The judge told the defense counsel, you will not refer to the prior sexual activity of the alleged victim. And that was not just with reference to the email.
Did the defense counsel have the opportunity to ask T.E. about her mother's discovery of the email?
Yes, Your Honor.
And defense counsel asked about the cheerleader versus the email issue, right?
That
whether she got the physical. Now, Why didn't, so what wasn't she permitted to do, the defense counsel permitted to do?
What she wasn't permitted to do was clarify that the mother had discovered an email, not just about sexual activity, which could have, in the minds of the panel, been sexual activity with the appellant. What a shocking revelation that would have been.
Well, wasn't the response, she never told me, she just said, have you ever had sex? Why isn't that, doesn't that put the inference before the members?
Because the inference creates confusion. If the mother had discovered an email that said the alleged victim had had sex with the appellant, then that's an appropriate question. Have you ever had sex? What was missing was the email said, it raised the inference at least, that T.E. had been sexually active with someone other than the appellant.
And you don't think that answer creates that impression? Doesn't create that inference?
No, Your Honor, there is
nothing. You just said, have you ever had sex? Was the response.
That is what T.E. testified to.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. And that
you don't think that creates the inference that the mother might have thought she might have had sex?
Yes, Your Honor, but it doesn't say with whom. If the email had been about the sex with the appellant, then the panel actually, if they drew that inference, they would be misled about the truth, and there would also be no motive to fabricate that the defense clearly articulated in the 412 motion if the email was about sex with the appellant. What is missing here is an unconstitutional limitation where the panel should have known the email was about sex with someone other than the appellant, and in fact, in the Article 32 hearing, the alleged victim testified about that. She had told her friend about it. There were things on email that her mother had discovered about that. And in fact, the alleged victim's privacy interests are so low in this case that the alleged victim nearly testified about the prior sexual activity and the contents of the email, except that trial counsel cut her off when the
trial counsel was questioned. The victim's privacy interests are low here? Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Versus the appellant's interest in having this evidence in. I would think you'd be pushing that angle, but you're arguing that the privacy interest is low. We're talking about a minor and about rumors of sexual activity, and you think the privacy interest is low?
I think when the appellant, when the government elicited the testimony from the alleged victim about prior sexual activity at the Article 32, when the alleged victim nearly discussed the contents of the email under questioning by the trial counsel, and the trial counsel cut her off, when the alleged victim told her friend about it, and when there are emails that are beyond just the alleged victim, that the privacy interests are low, when weighed against the probative value of the evidence which goes to a motive to fabricate, Your Honor.
Counsel, is it the defense argument that the mother knew of rumors of sexual activity, that the victim knew of the mother's knowledge of rumors of sexual activity, and therefore that gave her a motive to lie? Is that your argument? I'm trying to understand exactly what the defense position is here.
Yes, Your Honor, except there are some additional facts beyond that. It is that the mother learned of rumors that the alleged victim was sexually active, that the alleged victim actually was previously sexually active with someone other than appellant, as made clear in the statement of Mercedes Gilchrist and in T.E.'s Article 32 testimony.
And where does the defense at trial say they want to bring that specific evidence into evidence in this case?
Your Honor, it is not at trial, but in the fourth.
Well, if they didn't ask for it at trial, then why would the judge be obligated to consider that as part of the 412 motion? That is, if they had said at trial, we want to bring in all her past sexual activity to show that the mother was aware of it and those specific things, and that gave a motive to lie, that would be one case. But that's not the case we have before us.
Your Honor, the defense counsel is bound by the court's 412 ruling, which said you can't bring up her prior sexual
activity. I'm talking about in the 412 motion. In the 412 motion, the defense specifically said that we don't want to bring up any evidence of specific activity with a specific person.
That is correct, and I believe, Your Honor, it is with respect to extrinsic evidence. And in this case, The question that the defense counsel could have asked and should have been permitted to ask wouldn't have to reference a particular individual, but simply ask the alleged victim on cross-examination, isn't it true that someone other than the appellant previously, in your own words, messed with you?
And can you identify the place in the record where the defense counsel said to the military judge, that's the question I want to ask, and that your ruling will prevent me from asking it?
I can't point to such a place in the record where the defense counsel did that in response to the ruling. But the written motion of the defense counsel, the attached statement of Mercedes Gilchrist, and both the written and oral articulation at the 412 motion was very clear. This goes to her motive to fabricate. Her mother was going to discover that she was sexually active, or at least that was what was in the alleged victim's mind. And, Your Honor, I see that my time...
You can finish answering that question.
Your Honor, what was in the alleged victim's mind was that this looming physical exam, which shows sexual activity, and her first response to her friend, the first person she told about this incident, was, I'm afraid because it might show that someone other than appellant messed with me. The panel never heard that. That was the critical, even using the Banker test, the vital evidence that is both relevant and material to her motive to fabricate.
Thank you, counsel. You have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Captain Christopher Whitworth, and I, along with Major LaJean White, am representing the United States in this matter. The first grand issue was resolved in favor of appellant at court-martial, where the military judge permitted defense counsel to elicit testimony from the victim, who I refer to as TE, thereby establishing her motive to fabricate. Appellant sought and received permission to elicit testimony demonstrating that TE's mother discovered an email referring to sexual activity. Upon that discovery, TE's mother immediately said to TE that she was going to get a physical exam, and that as a result, TE became scared and immediately made her allegations against appellant. Now, in the pretrial motion from the appellant, which was a response motion to the government's motion in limine, appellant's stated purpose, this is Joint Appendix 2 at 9, was to illustrate TE's motive to fabricate. They wanted to reveal her motive to fabricate the allegations against the appellant to hide acts of consensual activity from her mother. What they were looking for here was not the sexual activity itself, but the trigger for TE to report at that point in time. The appellant's case, they made a painstaking case where they tried to point out inaccuracies that TE made throughout the record as far as time, locations, things of that nature. One of their points was that this allegation she made came on or when she first reported it to her friend, who I'll refer to as MG, was on the 19th of July, 2006. She had previously had a medical examination in October 2005. The conclusion of the range of dates for the offenses ended in January 2005. So there were some inaccuracies there that the defense's case went to. They were afforded this opportunity, excuse me, by stating in the 39A that basically what they were looking for was that within 24 hours she turned around and made these allegations of appellant after her mother discovered the email, that she reacted with fear at her mother's discovery of the email. And by the end of the Article 39A session, which came to be under the auspices of a 412 evaluation, it got down to the point where defense counsel said on the record, agreed with the military judge, that the precise question she wanted to ask of TE was, isn't it true that your mother discovered an email regarding sexual activity? That, in combination with on at least four occasions during the 39A, and these are, let me do some record sites, these are at JA 25, and JA 2 at 25 and 35 to 37, on four occasions, defense counsel stated that they would not be looking to submit any evidence about the contents of MG's email. And the government would like to remind the court that MG's email essentially, which was dated 20 July, essentially recounted the conversation between TE and MG on the 19th of July. At court-martial, TE testified to the majority of the contents of that information, in the key part being what her trigger for reporting was. So you've got defense counsel asking, then at the conclusion of the 39A, the military judge allowed appellant to, quote, refer to the mother's discovery of emails generically, that based upon those emails, the victim's mother wanted to take the victim to a gynecologist, and that the alleged victim then made the allegations against the accused shortly thereafter. That's at JA1 at 15 to 16. Both parties were then allowed to argue permissible inferences that would follow from that line of questioning. Now, during the court-martial, defense counsel successfully elicited from T.E. Her motive to fabricate, and then highlighted it in closing. At Joint Appendix 1 at 185, T.E. testified that she told her friend, M.G., that she was concerned about getting a physical exam because she thought it would show that she had been raped. At Joint Appendix 1 at 185 to 186, T.E. testified that her mother read an email, asked her if she ever had sex, and then told T.E. that she was going to get checked. And I'd just like to quote the language from that question for the court, because it shows that nexus or that trigger that appellant was looking for. Pardon me. So there's some debate about what email account that her mother read and saw this email, which contained this rumor of sexual activity. And after that was settled that it was her Yahoo account, she said, the defense counsel then said, and then she, meaning T.E.'s mother, decided that you, meaning T.E., needed to get a physical. T.E. answered, correct. Further down, the next question is from the defense counsel is, so did you get the physical because you were going to be a cheerleader, or did you get the physical because your mom read some emails? Answer from T.E. She never told me. She just said, have you ever had sex? And I said, no. She said, well, I'm going to take you to a doctor to get checked. So that really is what the government is trying to show, is that this motive to fabricate that appellant is alleging that they have not been afforded the opportunity to explain was there. It's on the record. It was a question that was asked by defense counsel. Essentially, there was no 412 analysis because it was done through a conversation between defense counsel and the military judge, and getting to that ultimate point where defense counsel agreed that the question they wanted to ask was a very specific question, was whether the email referred to sexual activity. And then if you were to place the framework of a 412 analysis back over that 39A, you would see that it would come to the same result, because the balancing test of 412 Charlie 3 essentially allows the weighing of the probative value of the evidence against the privacy interests of the victim. Now, what we can see here that was ultimately allowed, which was requested by appellant, was that they got to the motive to fabricate without getting into these rumors that were in this third-party email. And further, just...
Counsel, what I'm trying to ascertain here is the difference between a harmless error analysis versus an error analysis in that regard, because most of your point sounds almost like, and I know you're not making it this way, sounds almost like a harmless error analysis. That is, all the information came out anyway, so that the whatever's in the email wouldn't have made any significant difference. In that regard, what's left of the 412 analysis once all this other information came out? That is, why would you not then allow the details of the email out so the members would have no question at all as to the so that the fact finder would have no question at all as to what the specific content was that was at issue? What was being protected under 412 at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first, I'd just like to point out that as was mentioned previously, the military judge is confined to the proffer that was put forth by appellant. So in that regard, there couldn't really be an analysis outside of what was asked for and ultimately given. The getting into the details, other than not being requested by appellant, the information that the entire proffer was based upon, as I mentioned before, was her friend's email. Her friend's email essentially discussed how they came to have this conversation, and the sexual activity that's been alluded to is twofold. One is they were discussing how, and again, this is within this email, but how T.E. was afraid of her upcoming exam because Bubby, and we don't know who Bubby is, Bubby could be referring to appellant, Bubby could be, who knows, messed with me a long time ago. Messed with me doesn't equal sex. Messed with me could mean rape. We don't know. So what we've got there is just a very loose interpretation of an event. From there, we go to this rumor that T.E. was pregnant with Jared's baby. This is what the MG's email discusses another email, which was never admitted into evidence, which was the email that the mother discovered. Again, this was a rumor within the four corners of MG's email. The TE refuted that rumor, said it was not true. I believe the language used was then it was dropped, so it was never talked about again. So what we're dealing with in terms of the content of MG's email, we can't get there because it's rumor. There's nothing to prove it. If it went through a 412 analysis, and like this court did in Smith, if we assume the window that it was relevant and got some material, there's no way that the content, that rumored content that was refuted, could be material, especially in light of the question that was allowed at court martial, which allowed appellant to get to that Fifth and Sixth Amendment right to put forth a motive to fabricate.
So is it the government's view that if this evidence had been offered in a non-412 situation, it would have been excluded because of a 403 balancing or 401 relevancy because of the nature of the information itself? But let's put 412 aside. Where's the government's position on that?
Yes, Your Honor. If we put 412 aside again, and I know this is probably getting annoying, but I'd like to remind the court that the proffer didn't allow this. We're now going outside of the proffer. But this evidence would be inadmissible, 412 aside, under 403. You've got information that is very, very poorly written. It's difficult to decipher. It's within an email. It's not within the context of a sworn statement. And it's using a lot of slang language. It's using inside information that the reader, just from, again, looking at the four corners of the document, it's difficult to determine. What can be determined from the document is we're talking about rumors, and the rumors were denied by TE within that document. And as far as evidence being reviewed, especially 412 evidence, the military judge must take, when evaluating whether it comes in or comes out, must take that evidence at face value as being true.
And in this case, did the defense make any offer or effort or request to prove by external evidence whether those rumors were true?
No, Your Honor. They were, again, repeatedly asked on the record whether they sought to either admit the email itself or ask questions or cross-examine TE or any other witnesses about the contents of the email, and that was also not a road that was taken by appellant. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? Since the first grand issue before the court was previously resolved at court martial, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honors, the military judge did not rule on the first issue that is before this court in favor of the defense. The proffer is, in fact, in written format at Joint Appendix 2, page 9, and specifically says that the defense proffers that T.E. informed Ms. Gilchrist about this email, which we have been discussing, the statement Ms. Gilchrist provided to CID clearly says Ms. Taylor's the defense counsel articulates it as such, the proffered evidence reveals Ms. Taylor's motive to fabricate the allegations that Sergeant Gaddis to hide acts of consensual activity from her mother. That is the purpose of the proffered evidence. The proffered evidence was to show that she was, in fact, sexually active. The judge's ruling was you will not refer to prior sexual activity. That is the first point. The second point is that upon learning of the looming physical examination, T.E. said to her friend to whom she first made these allegations, I am concerned that it will show something because someone other than appellant messed with me. Whether that is appropriate or slang or clear, these are the words of the alleged victim, that someone else messed with her, and that's why she was afraid of having a physical examination. It is that fear that caused her to want to hide this information from her mother, and knowing she was being taken for an examination, it gave her a motivation to then make these allegations against the appellant. Your Honors, even if this court holds to the banker standard, this court should give little deference to the military judge's ruling here, because the military judge did not make a 412 ruling. The military judge made no 412 analysis. The military judge must have found the evidence was relevant because she didn't exclude it under 401. She simply made a conclusion that it would be confusing to the panel. That's not a permissible reason to exclude evidence under 403. The reasons under 403 are that it would mislead the panel or confuse the issues. Here the military judge came up with some hybrid basis, which is not permissible under 403 or under the precedence of this court. Therefore, the military judge must have misapplied 412, used in some way the balancing test that is instructed by Banker to come up with a reason to exclude this evidence. And yet, this court should, in fact, review, although typically under an abuse of discretion standard here, because there is no analysis, this court should review de novo and find that the evidence was, in fact, relevant and material. And even if this court determines that it should hold to the vital to the defense standard of Banker, there are reasons for this court to find that the evidence was vital. Number one, there was no other attack on the alleged victim's credibility with respect to her motive to fabricate. There were attacks on her credibility about details, but not on her motive to fabricate. It was a hotly disputed issue. Unlike many cases, the appellant took the stand here and said, what T.E. told you in her testimony is not true. I never sexually touched her. So it is very important when you're doing the materiality analysis to realize that this was a hotly disputed issue. For these reasons, it is appropriate to reverse the findings of the Army Court and set aside the findings and the sentence with respect to this. Although we have not spent much time on issue two, it is the defense position that the shifting of the burden to the defense after the defense shows that evidence is relevant and material, the continued shifting of the burden under the Banker requirement, which is not in the text of 412, is an unconstitutional shifting.
What does Banker do that 403 doesn't?
What Banker does is it puts the onus on the proponent after having already shown that they meet the constitutionally required exception to 412, it continues to place the onus on the proponent of the evidence, whereas 403 and the way that Pumpkin Seed and Powell and other circuit courts, federal circuit courts, have handled this.
Who does 412 put the burden on?
412 initially is a rule of exclusion, Your Honor, and places the burden.
So is it Banker or Rule 412 that creates the burden?
It is both. It is that the rule itself places the initial burden on the defendant, and I see my time has expired.
You can answer the question, then you have an opportunity to briefly conclude.
Thank you. Your Honor, Rule 412 initially puts the burden on the defense. if the defense can show one of the three exceptions, as appellant did in this case, that it is constitutionally required, then...
And it's in, right?
No, Your Honor.
But we keep it out if it were constitutionally required.
Unlike the federal rule, which doesn't have this balancing test for unfair prejudice to the privacy interest of the alleged victim, the military rule, and it is appropriate to do so, protects these privacy interests, but it should be done so considering the same factors that are considered in a 403 analysis. It is a test for probative value versus prejudicial impact. And specifically after the 2007 amendment, that prejudicial impact is limited by 412 to the privacy interest of the alleged victim.
You've answered my question, but you're on your dime now.
I have one follow-up, and that is that sounds like a facial constitutional attack, not an as-applied. Is it a facial attack?
Your Honor, it is not a facial attack for this reason. 412 can be read in a constitutional manner. If this court were to instruct that 412 and the privacy interest of the alleged victim, which 412 is designed to prevent, should be balanced against the probative value of the evidence, that would be a constitutional reading. And this court should embrace the Valenzuela-Bernal language, which specifically indicates even minor evidence of minor importance in the correct case can affect the outcome of a trial. That is what Valenzuela-Bernal instructs, citing to the Supreme Court's decision in Akers.
Thank you.
For the reasons stated, Your Honor, even if you apply the balancing test of Banker, this evidence was relevant, material, and vital to the appellant's case, and yet the military judge confused the panel by not permitting this appellant to put before it the very fact that the accuser, in the trial counsel's own words, the most important evidence, because there were no eyewitnesses, there were no forensic evidence, the case rested on T.E.'s testimony, and yet the panel never heard that T.E. sought to conceal prior consensual activity from her mother when her mother confronted her about being taken for a physical examination. For those reasons, the evidence was relevant, material, and in fact vital to the defense. For these reasons, we request that this court set aside the findings and the sentence.
Thank you, counsel, and we thank counsel for both parties for your submissions. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess pending further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until the further order of the court.